Good morning, everybody. I'm Dan. Yep. Quakers, we meet in the library upstairs, and every once in a while we come downstairs to talk at you guys, I guess is our role. From 2013 to 2015, I lived in Tucson, working with several different groups. Went back for a summer in 2016 and for a couple weeks in 2017, and still have a lot of those relationships there. So No More Deaths is one of the groups I did the most work with. I'll point out, especially to this group, that they are technically a ministry of the Universalist Unitarians in Tucson. The UUs are the fiscal sponsor of that nonprofit. This is kind of a big topic. You could get folks that have gotten their doctorates in humanitarian aid on the U.S.-Mexico border, so I'll try to provide as much of a 10,000-foot view as possible. And then I always think on a topic this big, it's more interesting if we can then kind of like choose our own adventure and choose the things that are most interesting to this group out of this topic. And since it is a Sunday morning, I will like speak to kind of some of the reasons why I was doing this work as a Quaker. So this is, right, the biggest thing about the border is that we can't really visualize it in a real way, so I always like to have pictures. This is a section of the border wall near Sasebe. And so I think when we, and this is the only picture of just words, or only slide of just words, when we think about border policy for the past 30 years since NAFTA was signed in 92, the main concept is this concept of deterrence and the kind of the explicit reasoning behind that is if we increase the difficulty of crossing illegally into the United States, at some point we'll reach this magic point where it is too difficult for anyone to come in and they'll stop coming. So that has been the framework that the United States has operated under for the past 30 years. There was a report done in 2011 that just looked at some internal documents from Border Patrol at the beginning of this process, where they were very explicit about, you know, how are we gonna know if deterrence is working? Some of those signs of success will be increased fees from smugglers, more sophisticated methods of smuggling, increased protests, more deaths, more fraud, more violence on the border. So like a lot of things related to the border, it is good to just acknowledge that in the 90s, we knew this was gonna happen. We kind of like walked into this policy decision with full knowledge of kind of the chaos and human suffering that it would bring. And I would say that is like the current theme with border policy in general, is that those that benefit most from the border, fully understand the human suffering and continue to go down that route. So, right, death by deterrence, I think when you talk about deterrence, you need, the understanding is it, when you increase deterrence, you will increase deaths. And so what does that actually mean? What does that actually look like? This is a little bit of an outdated map, but I think it's still fairly accurate. This is the Arizona border where I spent most of my time. So there, during 2014, you know, this is just a year in the past 10 years ago, where during that year there were 133 human remains found in the desert. Anthropologists, archaeologists say that number is the actual amount of deaths is 2 to 10 times the amount of found remains. That they get that broad range from missing person reports in Mexico and Central America, in the United States as well. Also, bodies deteriorate very rapidly in the desert, 3 to 4 months, I believe, depending on the season. So you have these incredibly remote areas, and then areas where people just aren't walking through, or officials aren't walking through in the course of 3 or 4 months. So it's kind of see the ways in which recovered human remains can be somewhat of a marker for the amount of actual deaths that occur. So this is just zooming in on that in the Arizona section of the border specifically. So, right, what does deterrence look like? There are one, two, three, four main big cities that are on the Arizona side of the border. So in the 90s, we put up large physical barriers in those cities and kind of close to roadways so that folks would no longer be able to kind of jump in a car, you know, get in a car, run across the border, jump into another car and drive away, right? So you put up those physical barriers in the city centers. And then people continue to, you're kind of forcing people to go into the more dangerous parts of the desert. And so I think like it's good to, and I'll show some pictures of this landscape, but it's good to remember the border is 3,000 miles of the most rugged terrain that exists in the United States. Rivers, valleys, mountains, very extreme desert conditions. So you cannot build a wall across the entire thing. Border Patrol does not want that to happen and kind of says that over and over again in reports that is unpractical and would not actually work. So the idea that these border walls push people to more remote parts of the desert. And then the other key part is these kind of black lines that exist on roads in that area. So once you people go into remote parts of the desert, right, they are walking in order to get picked up by a car. They put checkpoints on these roads, and every car that drives north through the checkpoint, that car gets stopped and checked. So essentially what is happening, you can see a little bit of a red line, is that right, we by deterrence, we move the border, we make the border even larger, right? Where people have to get north of a checkpoint in order to get picked up, which means that they have to walk for that much longer. And this just kind of shows right the percentage of deaths that happen in relation to the checkpoints, right? So the farther you are forcing people to walk, the longer you are forcing people to be in rugged wilderness with no kind of support, that's gonna increase deaths, right? So that is one aspect of deterrence on the border. This kind of concept of, and we can talk about deterrence if people are more interested in it. I would say deterrence is the number one framework, and it extends beyond the border into the interior of the United States, into the legal system, and to a lot of other ways. But that's the general idea and thought, is we're going to make this as dangerous and as deadly as possible. Which, this is the most recent map from Humane Borders, the red dots are recovered human remains. Has increasing deterrence has obviously a very huge human toll. So actual deaths 2 to 10 times as much, just in Arizona, Texas, within the past 6 years has really increased their amount of recovered human remains. New Mexico, a little bit as much, California, not so much. So at the very minimum, I would feel confident saying that within the past 3 years, something like the size of Winona County has died in that desert, which is a really hard number to kind of wrap your head around. This is a map from Humane Borders. They're another humanitarian aid group. What they do specifically is they put big blue drums on roadways in the desert. They put big flags above their drums, and they kind of, you know, keep those water barrels filled to try to just put water out there. It's hard to really kind of describe what doing a full day of hiking in the desert does to your body. When I was working there, I remember drinking 4 gallons of water just to not get a headache. Medically speaking, you need to drink about 1 gallon a day just to keep your kidneys and liver functioning. So the journey used to be 20 years ago, used to be like a 2 to 3 day trip. Now it has become, just in the interior of the United States, more like a 2 week trip. So, right, no person is going to be able to bring 14 gallons of water with them into the desert. So, in a very real way, food and water is a life-saving thing. Right, so this is a chunk of the landscape. Huge mountains, huge vistas, one of the most beautiful places in the world. But, right, again, imagine trying to build a barrier up 2,000 feet of elevation. In a lot of ways, and especially the more remote places that they talk about building walls, actually increases migration because you have to build roads to get out there. Once you've built roads, then cars can go on those roads. So just another, yeah. Again, this arrow is pointing to kind of a sliver of a trail going up the ridge of this hillside. That is a migrant trail. No More Deaths philosophy. There's another group, Humane Borders. What they do is they will drive these roads to kind of look for folks. So No More Deaths is kind of the extension of that, from putting water in barrels at the same one place, from driving around. No More Deaths wants to be on the trails, hiking, and putting water in remote places, like directly on the trail, so that folks essentially have to walk into it. Because if we're talking about water as an essential medical supply, you don't want to make people have to look for that. And then this is near Ajo, western desert of Arizona, one of the more dangerous places. That actually looks more like kind of classic, what you think of a desert, a lot of saguaro cactuses, very flat valleys, but also just very, very even more arid and more extreme. And so this is what not NGO humanitarian aid looks like on the US-Mexico border. A lot of ragtag tents that are falling apart with a spray-painted humanitarian aid cross on it. No More Deaths. This camp specifically is 10 miles north of the border, and it's all non-permanent structures because it's on borrowed land. And so we would operate this camp, both providing medical care. I was a certified EMT at the time, so communicating with doctors in town about how to best treat dehydrated patients. We would also use it as a staging area to map out trails, to collect water, to then drive it out to different areas, and food and water. And a lot of the work that also happens with No More Deaths is collecting abuses and collecting people's stories. And importantly, they have partnered with the American Red Cross to provide phone service at this camp specifically. A lot of times, if someone gets lost in the desert, cartels use that as an opportunity to say, we have your loved one locked away in a basement, you need to pay an extra $3,000 for them to be released. And then that person is actually not locked away in a basement, they're either lost or deceased. So in a lot of ways, just giving folks an opportunity to call their loved ones in the United States saves both those family monies, but also saves further extortion. The clothes tent at this camp as well. Socks, shoes, clothes are also, if you're going to continue to walk after leaving the camp, those we consider medical supplies. If you're going to be walking for 2 weeks, you need to do that in clean socks. You need to do that in good shoes, because if you don't, right, those become open wounds. Those open wounds lead to sepsis or diarrhea, and that leads to death in the desert. And saw a lot of families and children coming through the camp as well. Which is just a very intense reality. And then, so a lot of that work with No More Deaths looks like this, right? They try to have someone who speaks Spanish, someone who has medical skills, someone who can drive very rugged roads, and then someone who's able to navigate in that area. So ideally four people. Sometimes those four positions are down to two people. It's driving the truck to a specific location, filling up your backpack with as much water as possible, 7 or 8 gallons, and then, a bunch of cans of beans, and then hiking these trails for about half an hour, depending on the location, dropping those supplies, walking back to the truck, going to another spot, hiking for another half hour, just doing that over and over again, week after week, year after year. So, which also means that we burn through trucks super fast when you have 2,000 pounds of water in the back and you're going over huge roads. It's a lot. We would always make sure to draw nice things on the supplies that we leave. Coyotes with the cartels, we'd hear from migrants that coyotes from the cartels will sometimes say, don't take this food or water, it's a trap from Border Patrol. Coyotes can sometimes keep people in a vulnerable position because it gives them more power later on during the trip in general. So we always wanted to make sure that we would leave drawings on the supplies that wouldn't make sense for Border Patrol to do, You know, like a board ritual agent's not going to draw a picture of a panda bear hugging a cactus or something like that. You know, so they're often elaborate drawings. I found that the smiley faces and the hearts were usually seemed silly enough. So that's one of the things we do. There's a 5-gallon bucket. We would bring those out to put socks in, as well as electrolyte tablets and things like that. And then putting water underneath crates. There was a period of time, about a 2-year period, where for some reason ravens understood that they could get to the water if they were pecking through the plastic jugs. So we had used crates for a while. That ended abruptly for some reason. And so we stopped using crates. So it's kind of weird back and forth. Right, and another water drop. In one of the areas of the desert near the humanitarian aid camp, there are a lot of, we would call them cattle ponds, cattle tanks, just standing water. Right, obviously, if you have been hiking for 3 days, 3 or 4 days, and have not had water for that period of time, you will drink any water that you find. Drinking the stagnant water, right, will give you some kind of stomach bug, stomach disease, which leads to diarrhea, which is going to lead to dehydration and death. So we'd always be sure to try to leave water in front of these cattle tanks. Yep, same idea. There's a migrant path going through those bushes and putting the water as close to that as possible so that folks would see it in the nighttime if they were walking by it. And because we're a bunch of do-gooders, we'd always make sure to clean up any plastic bottles that we would find as well. This is a picture of a search and recovery with the Angels of the Desert, where they were a California-based group. We were doing this on the Tohono O'odham Nation. They have a big reservation right in the middle of the Arizona desert. Their nation is kind of cut in half by the border wall. So we were working with a tribal member to do a search and recovery. There is a nonprofit or two that tries to record deaths and does some work about recovering remains. No More Deaths is one of the only groups that will actually kind of go out and do search and recoveries. But even in that situation, it has to be very timely, like within the past couple weeks, and have a very specific idea of the location in order to do that, just to provide closure for the families involved. Yeah, and then kind of what I was speaking to, this is some of the graffiti work done in a small border community, Ajo, in that kind of western Arizona, speaking to the Tohono O'odham Nation, right, making a very clear political connection between Germany in the 80s and the Tohono O'odham Nation. In a lot of ways, and I would say I think in every way, the border very much is an occupied territory. Border patrol, there's a lot of border patrol agents, and they operate with near absolute immunity in that area. At least in 2017, they were the only federal agencies that did not have to count their bullets in their weapons before and after shifts. They can pull anybody over, do any searches. So you can imagine with that kind of wide range of powers, people of color living in that area tend to bear the brunt of that the most. So the Tohono O'odham Nation has a lot of stories of very brutal, kind of specific attacks to their tribal sovereignty. In 2016, they were trying to build a section of border wall that was going right through their creation story, kind of a very sacred spot. Through a lot of direct action and arrests and court cases, that has been stalled. Humanitarian aid is always legal. That's another aspect of deterrence kind of continuing to leach out over the past 30 years. No More Deaths has well-documented cases of Border Patrol agents destroying humanitarian aid supplies, cutting water bottles, things like that. When I was down there in 2011, I was arrested for leaving water on a wildlife refuge on the border. In Ajo in 2015, they arrested someone, a Nombre Des volunteer, who was operating a similar, Nombre Des was operating a similar humanitarian aid camp in the Ajo area. Migrants walked into the camp. He provided humanitarian aid and food and water. Border Patrol came in and arrested everybody and arrested Scott. He ended up being acquitted of those trials over 2 years. Another big aspect of what No More Deaths does is trying to set legal precedences to always say no matter what, humanitarian aid is never illegal. So they kind of are always taking up those cases and fighting them very aggressively. But we know that Border Patrol views any other groups working in those areas as kind of in direct opposition to them, and they try, when they have the opportunity to feel like build a good case against a volunteer, they usually try to take that. And so, right, talking about the border kind of going beyond the actual border, and how does that affect folks living in Minnesota? How does that affect us? So this shows a poll that was done recently. Is a particularly partisan poll. I think the work that humanitarian aid groups do on the border is political in some sense, but they have always been, both Democrats and Republicans have been bipartisan in being really bad on the border. But I think this, I was really surprised when I saw this interview this past month, because I think it shows a huge shift in attitude. And, right, I mean, maybe other folks saw this, but the whole poisoning the blood language is very well written and is not something that Trump would kind of say off the top of his head. It's very directly taken from Germany in the 40s. Is very much related to dehumanized language that was used specifically to dehumanize Jews during that time and to scapegoat them with issues. And so I think, yeah, for folks that kind of view themselves as MAGA Republicans, if they knew that Trump said that language, close to 100% agree with that idea that illegal immigrants poison the blood of our country. Even likely primary voters across political parties above 50%, right? So I remember started doing that work in humanitarian work in 2012 and having the thought of like, man, when I am older and have kids, I'll be able to come down to the border, walk across the border wall that has been torn down, and like show this camp to my children and say, this is what we had to do at this point, but we no longer have to do this. And I think maybe speaks to somewhat of my naivety and my optimism, but the window has shifted so far to the right. It used to be that any kind of talk around border security was always attached to some kind of practical fixes to our immigration system. I think this past week, reading the news about Trump kind of stepping in and asking for a border bill to not be passed is really emblematic of the past 30 years. I think the border and border policy exists primarily as a tool to kind of feed resentment, racial resentments, fear, and division. And I think Trump saying specifically, I want to use that in 2024, don't pass any laws around this, I think is just laying out very plainly what has been happening in politics for the past 30 years. And the border in general has become a symbol, and a lot of the talk and the rhetoric around it, you know, doesn't really match up with reality on the ground. And so I think kind of going there and being in that place specifically, you kind of see that disconnect. And then kind of more recent updates, when we were there, we kind of were there with this first huge wave of refugees from Central America were starting to come through. And kind of did a lot of work on the Greyhound bus station, working with those folks, getting them tickets. One of the updates for humanitarian aid on the border now is that crisis is essentially happening every day, where there are 500 plus folks every day from Central America being kind of deposited at the border by cartels and then Border Patrol processing them for asylum refugees, and then just also dumping them across the border in the United States. So still a lot of deaths happening. Deterrence is still increasing the amount of deaths, but there's also this new aspect of this Bush-era law where you can't catch and release Central American migrants. They have to get processed to be to seek refugee status. Because of that Bush-era law, it feels like there's a little bit of a loophole where folks can present themselves at the border and then come into the United States through Border Patrol. And yes, so because they're tax deductible, I would highly recommend folks donate to No More Deaths. They are, you can be pretty sure that if you are concerned about folks dying in the desert, that if you give them $1.50, that $1.50 will be bought to buy a gallon of water. It's a pretty one-to-one combination there. And in general, I feel like talking to why I felt compelled to do it from a spiritual perspective, I think Quakers have a very long history of being on the forefront of saying, of arguing for the expansion of human rights. They did that with slavery in the 1700s and 1800s before other folks were talking about it. And I feel similarly with folks that come across the border, legally or illegally, that these human beings deserve rights, they deserve respect. That means that they don't deserve to die of dehydration in the desert. And I think seeing the light in everyone and being compelled to honor that compels us to expand human rights wherever we see them being restricted. So if you want to know, here's my last slide with tons of words on it. If you want to know exactly all the things that they do, No More Deaths is a good community-driven organization who partners with a wide variety of organizations in the desert, and kind of the work that they have done has evolved over the past 20 years in a really, I think, inspiring way. And they're an organization that is well deserving of any monies from Minnesota. So it's almost 11. I don't know if folks have questions about any of this. But yeah. Oh yes, maybe 1, 2, 3, and then we'll be done.
Thank you, Dan. How did these experiences at the border impact your own humanity?
Yeah, I think that is a question that humanitarian aid workers across the world deal with and understand. I think I find a lot of solace in Quakerism in that listening to that still small voice and just understanding the difference between the way the world as we want to see it be and the world as it is, and holding that difference and holding that tension. And I think humanitarian aid, be it in Palestine or on our border, allows you to look that difference in the face fully and to fully hold that tension and to still fully say, I believe that a better world can be possible. And I think there's a lot of folks of faith that have done that work. There's also a lot of folks of no faith at all, very anti-faith with a lot of the volunteers with No More Deaths. And I think it is part and parcel to the human experience and the full range of emotions to understand that the world is full of folks who are suffering immensely and full of folks who profit from that immensely, and that it is our job to be on the side of the folks that are suffering. Yes, they have provided some support to different nonprofit groups in Texas. Brownsville, I know that I know that there are volunteers who have done the work in Arizona for years that would make trips to Texas to provide assistance and advice to those folks. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it once again, to talk about the idea of deterrence and just the fact that things have gotten worse and worse over the past 10 years speaks to this idea of trying to make it as terrible and as crazy, as dangerous as possible across the border. You know, so when I heard that they had put a floating barbed wire fence in the middle of the Rio Grande, it was absolutely, of course, that's deterrence. Like, that's not surprising at all. That is 100% within the framework of deterrence. And I imagine that we will hear things only, you know, the rhetoric being what it is. I think history has shown us when you fully embrace that rhetoric and use it to your advantage, that the human cost only increases.
So,
yeah, we, Rachel and I were just talking about that this morning, actually. So part of my journey was, I grew up in Worthington, Minnesota. A lot of first-time immigrants living there. And so when I learned about the border in kind of 2009, I had no idea that folks were dying on the border, and had like a very visceral memory of like, I knew those kids. I knew their parents. And just kind of being really surprised that folks would risk their lives to go to Worthington, Minnesota. But that's what's happening across the United. So having that personal connection, I think it was the same thing that has drawn me into the Catholic Worker, that drew me into the Catholic Worker in my early 20s as well. And I've wanting to, in a world that is full of very complex problems and very complex reasonings, to fully inhabit a black and white position at that age. I think at the Catholic Worker, it's fully inhabiting the position of nobody should be homeless, and we're going to provide a home for somebody. On the U.S.-Mexico border, it's no one should die of exposure in the desert, and we're going to putting a gallon of water on a trail is a very concrete thing that you can do to prevent that from happening. I think as I've gotten older, and as I've started dipping my toes in politics, I've become more okay with the gray areas and the complexities, and feeling okay operating in that gray area. But I think at that time, being fully and committing myself fully to a very objectively, a very black and white thing was very, I think, is what I needed to do. And I think, you know, as I've gotten older, I feel better able to kind of sit in that tension of how I want to see the world and how the world as it is, and how I can work in that middle space to try and make change. Yeah.